I'm not gonna waste any time tonight, okay? Jumping right in. We have heard here, if you've been with me any amount of time, the idea of practicing the presence of God. That I think, is one of the highest spiritual disciplines that we are called to. Reality is, God is around us. God is before us, ahead of us. God is behind us when we fall. God is above us and below us and to our right and to our left. And so one of the biggest ideas of prayer is coming to attention, coming to that awareness that God is present, that God is there, that he is at work. And so we learn to practice that presence, to be in this constant conscious interaction with God, wherever we're going. And so I think the flip side of that would be true as well. If we are to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, we also have to practice the presence of people. So that people that are standing right in front of us who are made in the image of God, what does it mean to be aware that here is one who is like God? And how do I find the face of God in this person? So we read from the Sermon on the Mount. Sermon on the Mount, we did a long series on that years ago. You could refer back to that if you like. I'm not going to cover all that material. That's three long chapters. But the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus really announcing this new world order that he has brought. And he likes to call it, refer to it as the kingdom of God. Now, in the specific section that we read, that's on Matthew 5. You can look at that if you like. Jesus is addressing certain issues. Notice they're all about people. So he's addressing anger. He's addressing lust and divorce and the power of words and retaliation and revenge and the love of many enemies, but the love, how we treat the one who is opposed to us. And addressing these things, Jesus is calling us to the highest ethic of love. Can I give you this challenge? I fall in this category sometimes. You're in the middle. We're not in the middle. We're at the beginning of summer. You may have been a Christian for a while. You may have been in church for a while. You may be familiar with the story of God. And we can get kind of blasé with that. And I'm not really feeling it. Doesn't feel alive. Can I encourage you this? Turn to the Sermon on the Mount and look at how Jesus trusts you and me. What he entrusts us with, the high calling that he is willing to give to us to say, I think you can live to this. That might stir it up again because we're given the highest ethic of love. That is, he is teaching us that people should never be targets for our anger and our insults. Keep this in mind while perusing Facebook and Twitter. If you are prone to anger, don't go on Facebook and Twitter, I would recommend. Jesus is teaching us that people should not be viewed as sexual objects for our own gratification. A lot of problems out there that we're seeing in the culture. People are getting called on things that they used to not get called on. So our culture desperately need to hear this. We in the church desperately need to hear this. Jesus teaches that men should not treat their wives as property that can just be dismissed according to their whim. In the first century Jewish world, women would not have been able to divorce. That just wasn't possible. And as tragic as it is in our culture when two people who have come together feel like that they have to part and that that is the best route, I would say that isn't what Jesus is specifically addressing here. Kind of goes with the lust one, that men can't just view their wife as property, and when they no longer want what they got, they just send them away and get a new one. Jesus says you can't do that in the kingdom of God. Jesus is also telling us about the power of words. Be careful how you use words. As Christians, there should be no need for clever clauses in small print. We shouldn't manipulate language in such a way as I'm going to gain an advantage over another person. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. And he says, anything beyond that is of the evil one. Then he goes into some fun things. He talks about retaliation and revenge. You know, what's normal, somebody does something to you, you do something back. And Jesus isn't saying just be a doormat and let people walk on you, but he is suggesting we be more creative than usual. And he suggests these surprise tactics, what I call reverse fighting, where you kind of stand up for yourself and in some way it shames the other person and yet still honors them. And then Jesus calls us to this, what Van Morrison's saying, crazy love. It's like, love your enemy. Like, not just the people that like you and think like you, but the person who is actively opposed against you. I call you to be more creative and have this kind of crazy love even for your enemy. Now, these are all examples. Important examples, I think, to be sure. But I don't think what you're reading in the Sermon on the Mount is exhaustive in scope. In other words, the Sermon on the Mount isn't a systematic legal code that's like big lawyer book that sits in the library. And when you come across a contemporary situation, you pull the law code down and you look up chapter and verse, you go, oh, okay, this directly correlates to what is happening in our present day culture. I think that's a bad way to look at the Sermon on the Mount. I think that's a bad way to look at the Bible, period. But so don't think in terms of law or some kind of comprehensive code, but what we are given is a trajectory towards a Jesus-style love of neighbor. So not a systematic law code. Too many people approach the Bible with that. It's not a systematic law code where you can look up every detail that you will ever encounter. If you come at it from that approach, I think you'll be sorely disappointed. But what we do find, when we read it properly, I believe, is a trajectory, a movement, a thrust towards the love of the other. And then I think from that trajectory, we can conclude other things. So we've talked about this before. I think the Bible is a little bit like jazz improv. So you have the Bible. It's not this encyclopedia that has that. We sometimes present it that way, don't we? It has all the answers to everything you encounter in life. And I'm going to tell you, no, it doesn't. But what we do have is this story, this narrative, this movement, this thrust, and it gets ever bigger as you read the Bible towards its end, and you are called to inhabit and indwell that story and know that story and its characters and its teaching so well that when you find yourself in a contemporary situation, you understand the flow and the movement. Like a good jazz musician, he knows the notes and the chords so well that even as he's called up on stage in the moment, he's able to play with a group. So we're given this trajectory, and I think from it you can conclude other things. Like, poor people should probably not be exploited as cheap labor by rich corporations and rich companies. We just talked about last 2 weeks, minorities should not be subjected to systematic injustice because of their race. All over the world, there's this problem. People should not be persecuted because of their religious beliefs. So in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is actually forcing us to grapple with a rather big question. What are people for? Some of you might have encountered Wendell Berry. He's a fantastic farmer, writer, essayist. Sometimes you think farmers and you think, well, they have this kind of earthy wisdom, but man, this guy just has a beautiful poetic way of writing about culture and nature and people. And he has a whole group of essays called What Are People For? And I think it's a good question to ask. We share this planet with about 7.5 billion other people. What are they for? Ever been a crowd of people? Like, what are all these people for? Like outside, I have this network of family and friends and church people and people I might do business with and buy and sell things from, just people around. Outside that network, there's all these people that I will never know, maybe never encounter or interact with in my life. What are all these people for? Are they all just extras on the set of a movie called Me? Like it's about me. It's my movie, but we have to have other people moving around, buying and selling and doing things. You know, we got to have somebody who works for the sewer company. So there has to be some extras. Are they resources? Are people resources for our own agendas? And I don't even mean that in a totally bad way. Like there's some real leaders. There's some real creative people out there with great imaginations and they have these ideas and they goals. And so are people there to, you know, hey, come alongside with me and we're to lead the way. You know, one of my guys is Eugene Peterson, and I gotta tell you, Eugene Peterson hates the word human resources. He loathes, like you would never want to say this because he's a quiet, gentle man, but if you said that word around him, I figure you might meet another side of Eugene Peterson. He hates that term. He said, if there's two words that never go together, it's human resources. It's kind of like, I thought of Soylent Green, and if you don't understand that, no worries. If you do, then you're probably laughing. Are people objects to be analyzed and categorized and utilized for our benefit? Now, I think we're all sitting here and we say, of course not. That approach to the worth and the purpose of people is entirely antichrist. And you say, antichrist? I mean, isn't that the dude in Revelation, that one world figure that rises up and brings a one world government? No, that's Jesus. Jesus is the only one that's brought a new world order to us. And actually, antichrist, just for our own knowledge, is never found in the book of Revelation. That probably comes more, my opinion, from bad eschatology. But it's actually a term in the epistles of John, and the way he uses it has to do with people that deny the humanity of Christ. So anything that is anti-human, even anything that butts up and goes against humanity, is antichrist. So what are people for? Well, we know this. People are bearers of the divine image. And as such, they are to be unconditionally loved and respected, always accorded justice, and given proper dignity as an expression of our love for God. If all we had was the first chapter of Genesis, we could somewhat derive that from that. Because in Genesis, in telling us the origin story of humans, the Bible has a little bit of fun, and it says humankind, it's this play on words. It says humankind was formed from the humus. Adam was formed from the Adama. So it's like souls come from the soil. God said it like this: let us make man in our own image according to our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So humankind is formed from the soil. God breathes into the breath of life. And so human beings are this synthesis of the breath of God and the dust of the earth. And the most important thing is the Imago Dei, that they are stamped and marked by the divine. So to mistreat, to use, to abuse other people is an insult to God. So we don't often think of it like that. It is a kind of blasphemy. Here stands before you one who is marked and bears the image of the Almighty, but you have a problem with them, so I insult them. So now they're no longer, in my mind, a person created in the image of God. They are an object to which where I hurl my anger or insult. And this is a sort of blasphemy. I am literally spitting my venom on one who is marked by God. Here is a creature who, in the process of spiritual formation, can grow and become more and more like God, but now they've become an object to which I direct my rage and wrath. This is what I mean by trajectory. So Sermon on the Mount doesn't cover everything that we will ever encounter, but I think it gives us a trajectory. And I think people informed by the light of Christ can never support torture. There's an example. Like, never. There's never going to be an occasion, even though you can read in the recent Barna reports, a lot of evangelicals think that that's okay, but never. That Jesus was a victim of torture shows just how horribly that can go wrong and how evil actually torture really is. Here's Jesus Christ, the totally, holy, fully innocent one, tortured in the name of security. See? He is a threat. We'll not only kill him, but we will torture him first as an example. And for a Christian, the end never justifies the means. Actually, I would say the end, the goal, and the means intermingle together in this process of becoming. They're much more part of each other than we would like to admit. And so the moment that we embrace the idea that evil means can lead to a good end, like we're in our minds, oh, this might be a little bit sketchy, but it's going to be for a good cause. We know at that moment we're holding the hand of the evil one. Reminds me of the Rolling Stones song, "Pleased to meet you, hope you guess my name, but what's puzzling you is the nature of my game." See, that the end justifying the means, that was actually the third temptation of Jesus that he dealt with in the wilderness. Sincerely, Satan was telling Jesus, man, why are you going this route? You, why would you go the way of the cross? The kings, the pharaohs, the emperors, the empires, all before you. It's your, grab the throne. Assume the march into Rome, say sit, and they'll all sit and grab the throne. Grab a hold of the crown. Jesus sees through this and he says, it is written that you should worship the Lord your God only, and him only should you serve. See, he understood that to use violence in the name of God is in fact to bow down to the Satan, to go the way of Satan. And he resists that. So what are people for? I keep coming back to that. What are people for? People are for sharing life with, because life is a shared experience. It isn't a solo project. A lot of people would think that they would like it like that. But you can't do it alone. You aren't meant to. You couldn't do it anyway, even if you think you could. We're kind of all in this together. Think of something, we used this recently, this example, but think of something as simple as language, your mother tongue. At a moment in time, you were trained, ever since you were little, you heard people using words, and then a moment in time, you were trained, and we kept adding on different things. Remember diagrams and all that? Oh my goodness. Ooh. It's even more fun when you do that in grade class. Wow. Didn't get much better than that. But at a moment in time, this was passed on. Like, this isn't yours. You didn't come up with it. You didn't develop. It was a gift that was given to you. It's a gift of the community. It's a gift that comes from people sharing life with each other. And in a moment in time, it was passed on to you. And now you have it, and you can communicate and interact with other people. Now, unfortunately, many people in our world have not learned to view life as a shared experience of love. Instead, we have been shaped, we have been formed, we have been conditioned in such a way as to view life as a competition. The majority of people outside our inner network, so our family, our friends, our church, the people that we might buy and sell goods with, all these kind of things, we tend to view as competitors. So they might get it first. We function out of scarcity. Oh, there might not be enough, so we got to get this first. And oh, look, they got a new car. Churches do this. Ah, look at their doctors. Oh, they got a new building. How'd they raise that much money? See, all of that is, we view life, it's almost like one giant reality TV show. I mean, I think those shows come from because we are that way, and then we watch them and imitate it. So it's hard to know. Art imitating life, life imitating art. I think it goes round and round and round. But this is not what life is like. Life is not a competition. If we have this paradigm, if we have this outlook, and this is the paradigm that is very much passed down to us from our culture, then we will tend to dehumanize people, right? We will categorize, we'll be very simplistic too. We will categorize people as winners and losers. And that is a false paradigm. That is a lie. It comes from the false self. Why? Because life is not a game. It is a gift. The purpose of life is not to win. It is to love well. If the Bible teaches us anything, it teaches us that. And in our culture, in American society, what the Bible would call the world, now the world, not the cosmos, not the physical, tangible things around us, not nature, but the world mindset that we tend to get molded into. So the world has this criteria for categorizing people as winners or losers. And if we're honest, it is based mainly on four things. You can pretty much pick up any Sky Mall magazine, go to Barnes & Noble's, and their vast array of magazines. Go to any magazine that comes to you in the mail, turn on any commercial. I mean, this is the fishbowl that we're in. It's mainly based on four things: wealth, status, education, and appearance. So if our mind is not being renewed in Christ, if we're not being immersed in the teachings of Jesus and putting them into practice, if we're not absorbing the lessons of the Sermon on the Mount and gaining this new trajectory, if we just kind of grow up in America, in our culture, in our world, and we absorb what's happening around us, then we will tend to evaluate people and we will categorize them as winners or losers, and it will be generally based on those four things. So the rich, the important, the well-educated, the good-looking are winners, and the rest are various levels of losers, however we would define that. And one way, I have lots of people in my life that I know from the past that would say, oh, the Bible, why do you still talk? Like, the Bible's so outdated, archaic, like it is not relevant to the present situation. I say, one of the ways that you know the Bible is real is like go to something like Genesis 1 and you can watch it actually play out in real time every day. So when we function like that, that is more poisoned fruit from the forbidden tree of judgment. Think of that. Human beings operate from their knowledge. This is my understanding of good and evil. Winner, loser. Good, evil. He's rich, she's a 10, winner. They make minimum wage. Oh, they're barely a 5. Oh, they don't have that education. They can't be hired. Loser. See, that's poison fruit from the forbidden tree all the way back in Genesis. But yes, of course, the Bible's outdated and archaic and makes no sense to our time at all. See, Genesis is this Hebrew poetry saying, hey, friends, this is how things got all set off course. Jesus never uses this kind of criteria to categorize people. Winners, losers. What's really interesting is if you look at Jesus, Jesus seems to go out of his way to focus attention on the so-called losers. I mean, who's Jesus hanging out with? Where is he at? Where is the majority of his time going? With people who in the first century were categorized as losers. Here's a fun one for you. In the winner's loser's game, Jesus was clearly not a winner. Think about it. He's not rich, doesn't have social status. I mean, at times he got a little bit popular. That's because the miracles were coming. The moment they stopped, yeah, we're out of here. At the end of his life, there's not many people hanging around. He's uneducated, and according to Isaiah, there's no beauty about Jesus that we should desire. So Jesus was a loser. And most immediately then, you should recognize that any system that would categorize Jesus as a loser is deficient, should be rejected. Now, in this world, there are wealthy people and there are those that don't have a lot. There are those who are very well educated and those who have no education at all. There are those who, what was the other one? Oh, very well known. You would see their face, you hear their voice, and we'd all, oh yeah, we know that person. And there are those who are constantly overlooked. There are those who are good looking, and that's most of us. And then there are some not so much. But those categories do not equate to making people winners or losers. Those categories have more to do with luck than the winners like to admit. You know, it has a lot to do with what family you were born into. What time and place do you live in? What country and nation do you reside in? How did you turn out in the genetic lottery? What did you do to deserve that? Nothing. It's pretty random. That's why for the early church fathers, they said this, look, the foundational virtue is humility. If you are ever gonna grow into the character of Christ, if you're ever gonna climb this ladder of ascent and become more like God, then the foundational virtue is the humility of Jesus. I even think sometimes be careful of the language, God has blessed me. Now, hear me, as an act of humble gratitude, yes, everything I have, these good gifts are from God, fine. Just be careful. Sometimes the way we say things, be careful when using it in comparison. Like, God has so blessed me to live in America. Well, what about the poor chap that lives in Bangladesh? Is he cursed? No. It's more of a random thing. The you that was came from your parents, that was formed and developed and changed over time and all the complexity of that, and that you are here and not somewhere else, and that you are in this moment in time in history and not somewhere else, that's somewhat how it felt to you. A lot of that, if we're honest, is random. In the scriptures, if you're blessed by God, it is only and solely and entirely that you might bless those less fortunate. It's always never this, oh, I'm blessed by God and I have the, no. You're blessed by God not to hoard this, but that you might then be a conduit of blessing, that it would flow to someone else. That's really the only thing that makes sense. So we don't, if we use this language of winners and losers, just remember we don't get to determine who is a winner or a loser. We're not the judge. Maybe there are winners and losers, but we are not on the committee. We're not like those Olympic judges of old who are called to evaluate and hold up our number. We don't get to do that. All of that is left to Christ. And here's what Jesus would say about this. Jesus uses all kind of provocative language here. He says many who are winners, or he uses the language of many who are first, will actually be losers. And many that we assume are so-called losers will be winners. And the point is this, there will be surprises. It is not as you assume. And then he goes on to share the parable of a rich man who was obviously a winner. He was wealthy, he was well known, he dressed in fine linens, he ate sumptuously every day. And in the first century world, that meant you were blessed by God. You had all these things and you were doing so well because you were a winner, and obviously God has blessed your existence. And then there was Lazarus the loser, who was homeless and poor and sick and relatively unknown and constantly overlooked. And then Jesus says, in the final analysis, in the final judgment, in the final assessment of things, everything is completely reversed and not what you expect. The guy who was the winner ends up losing, and the loser turns out to be a winner, and that comes to us from Jesus. Part of what made the early church so unique and at times so threatening was its egalitarianism. It was committed to equality. They held deeply to the idea that in the church, we are equal. And that doesn't maybe sound so radical to us because we have evolved that way, but that was unheard of actually in pagan society. To the pagan world, the social structure that they observed in the church was not only scandalous, like that's not how society works and functions, but it was actually hostile to them. It made the Roman senators very, very nervous. Like, hey, we have this subculture that exists within the empire where they're treating everybody the same. Where's that going to go? Where's that going to end up? How is that going to shake what we have, the status quo, what we've built? They had the paterfamilias, so it started with the emperor and worked its way down to the husband of even the peasant home was like the emperor of the home. And so there was this order and there was this structure, and this is the way we do things, and everybody has their place. And so they're saying, what do you mean these Christians, they're shaking up the status quo? And this was the impetus, as you can imagine, for many persecutions. I mean, think of it, in the early church, so your first century Rome, think of this. So suddenly men and women, rich and poor, educated, uneducated, Roman and foreigner, are all gathered together in the same assembly as equals. That would have not happened anywhere else in culture. All these same people enter into the same water to be bathed, baptized. All of these people come to the same meal and eat the same food as brothers and sisters. And the powers and principalities and the Senate and the emperors, they went berserk. They said, look, if everybody starts treating everybody the same, that threatens the privileged ones. So maybe a few bishops could be thrown to the lions. See, that's where all of that comes from. Alan Kreider, he's a guy who's kind of an authority on the, if you talk about the early church, generally mean the first three centuries. And he's good. He spent his life studying really what did the church look like in those first three centuries. And at the end of one of his writings, he kind of helps us take a visit to the early church. He helps us walk through what exactly it would look like. So we arrive. Let's picture this in our mind. You have to use your imagination. I don't have a lot of pictures on this. We arrive, Alexandria, maybe it's the year 230, and a lot of this information comes from a document that was actually written at that time and gives us kind of the protocol of what a Christian assembly would look like. So we have a good idea. So we're in Alexandria, northeast of Egypt. There's a very vibrant Christian community alive and well there. They meet in a house, probably the house of a wealthy member, a little bit larger. I like to think it looks like this, little Roman villa. And the church has two deacons that are helping. And the first deacon, he stands at the door, and this is going to surprise maybe some of you, but he stands at the door, and this is the word Alan Kreider actually uses, almost like a bouncer. So imagine a deacon, hey, where, hand me your whatever. I don't know what they had. But he stands there kind of as a bouncer because his task was primarily about who is going to be admitted. And you go, what? Well, this isn't a public gathering. I don't understand at that time. This is a private gathering. You got to imagine there's secret people trying to come in and cause it. So this was a private gathering. And the people admitted were Christians and catechumens. Those are prospective Christians. They're in this process of formation that's going to lead or end in baptism. And so we could say they are Christians in training. So these are the people that are admitted in. So imagine they come in, they sit down much like we do. They might have a Brian Bope in the back doing sound. And they do a series of prayers and songs and liturgies, not unlike probably what we did here. And then comes the penultimate moment. Now, the ultimate moment is what we always do, is everything kind of is moving towards the Eucharist that is at the center. The penultimate moment was when the bishop stood up and opened the scriptures and read them and began to expound upon them. So imagine the bishop is giving his sermon, and this document, believe it or not, from AD 230 talks about late arrivals. So obviously they had, you know, some of the same problems. What do you do with late arrivals? Because, and for them, this is a smaller gathering in a home. It's probably a big home, a spacious home, but it's still a home. So you get a number of people in there. It can get rather crowded. So believe it or not, it's that specific. The document says the deacon on the outside will admit this person as they come into the gathering, as he did for other people. And the other deacon will then assist them. And here's how specific it gets. If it is a wealthy, well-known person, they can just stand in the back so as not to disturb the gathering. I like it. If they are elderly, someone younger can give up their seat. So you can imagine maybe the second deacon going, hey, come on, man, you got to stand up, come on. And younger person stands in the back, elderly person sits down and has a seat. What if a poor person? What if somebody different skin, foreigner, They knew they were Christian. I don't know if they had secret passwords and kind of things, but the Christian has come in, but they're a foreigner. People don't know them well. What happens with them? The document says the latecomer that is poor is to be prominently seated in the front. If that doesn't happen, the bishop will stop his sermon and make sure the poor are provided a good seat. And we as good Americans go, what? I mean, they're late. That's their problem, you know? They're provided a good seat. And if need be, the bishop will give his own seat to the poor man. You can imagine the seat of the bishop. We got to work on this at our church. Had a name. It was called the cathedral. That's where we get that. But they had a seat up front because they would later be standing up to give, to open the scriptures, read them, expound upon them. And so if need be, the bishop would stop his sermon and help this person come to the front, and they would be given the cathedral. I said, why are you telling us this? Well, do you see what's happening here? The bishop, the communal leader, is actually to make a scene. And by embodied example, he teaches behavior that reveals the community's convictions. That in the church, all Christians are of worth. The church has no special regard for the wealthy or for the well-known. The church honors the poor, the least of these. What are people for? People are for sharing life with, and they are for learning how to love well. We love God supremely by loving our neighbor as ourselves. Jesus says that's the summation. Like, here's what happens. We get so caught up in minutia, like the overarching storyline of the Bible. Oh, there's so many pieces, I don't get it. And there's elements of theology I can't seem to wrap my head around. And this passage of scripture, this makes absolutely no sense to me. And Jesus says, the summation of it is this. Love God with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Seek the kingdom first. Learn in your daily existence to have this conscious, ongoing conversation with Jesus. Do that. And then love your neighbor as yourself. And actually, the two are inseparable. They're distinct, Like there's two commandments there. Your neighbor's not God, although made in the image of God. There's two commandments, love God supremely, love your neighbor as yourself. But these things really can't be separated. It is like the ocean and the shore. They intermingle. They become one. You cannot do one without the other. You can't do one without the other. If you say, I love God supremely, I really deeply, I am a convicted Christian, I love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and what we talked about the last 2 weeks, you're a racist, you don't love your neighbor well, the Apostle John would say to you, then what you do is you practice a deep self-deception. You, in fact, don't love God, you just say you do. You know, John does, it's not real hard to understand that section of scripture, right? If you say you love God, but you don't love your neighbor, you don't treat your neighbor properly, you in fact don't love God, you simply say you do, and your concept of God is more than likely just a deified projection of your own attitudes, ideas, and opinions. See, so it's not really God that you love, but it's this distorted image of God that you have created. That's what you love. So you have to, in the face of your neighbor, recognize the image of God and love God supremely by loving them as you would yourself. And it's also the other way around, because we have many in our culture that would say, well, you know, I don't really care for all this God stuff. I mean, that you can have the God business. I'm just going to go out there and I'm going to do justly. I'm going to do right by people, and I'm going to be kind to everybody. And I'm gonna say to you, along with every church father that ever existed, you will never, ever, ever be able to pull that off long-term. The formation and the energy and the sustaining spirit to treat your neighbor as yourself and to do justly in this harsh world comes from the heart of God. It comes from the heart of God. The only reason you would have a desire to do that is because you are connected to the Almighty who shares his life with you. So we kind of pat ourselves on the back. Oh, I want to go do good in the world. That's great. That comes from the heart of God. So that's important. Two commandments never can be separated, always go together. Love God, love neighbor. And Jesus would say this, in as much as you do this to the least of these, you have done it to me. Now suddenly Jesus' line makes sense, right? I was like, wow, we're doing it to the poor. How are we doing it to you? Because as you love your neighbor and see the face of God in your neighbor, you love God. Friends, what are people for? What of all these? You ever stand in a crowd, a throng of people, and think, Thomas Merton has a great description of one time. He stood out in a crowd of people at a fair, and he just let his hands reach out, and he felt all of these humanity walking beside him, and he thought, every one of these people is deeply, intimately loved by God. What are people for? They're for sharing life with and learning how to love well. Could this be like, so I'm trying to bridge the gap between what Liesl talked about last week and then Bruce is coming up. So next week I'll try to bridge that gap with the Sermon on the Mount. Could this be our practice, let's say for the next 2 weeks, and then maybe it'll stick? What if we could learn to see people for who they are, not who we want them to be? What if we could just the next 2 weeks consciously, and I would pray that the Holy Spirit does that, that every encounter we have, because there's obviously people we just, you know, there's tension. We don't really enjoy their presence. What if we could learn to see people for who they are? Deeply loved by God, stamped and marked by the Almighty. And we might never know, but in the process of life and development change, they might become more like God than we will ever be. What if we could see people who they are, not just, well, I wish they wouldn't do that. I hate, oh, that person, you know, we do that. We get that person stands so close when they're talking to us. I can't stand that. What if for the next 2 weeks, we kind of push those thoughts aside and say, what, who's in front of me? Jesus, help me to practice the presence of people. If you can bend down and wash the dust from people's feet and be that present, can I, in every business encounter, all my buying and selling goods, going out to dinner, could I practice people's presence and just like, even my spouse, just as they are, I'd like them to be this way. I'd like them to be a little bit better looking. No. Well, hopefully you don't think that. But I wish they went, oh, they have this, this thing they do. That just. But what if we could push that aside? Like, this is who they are. At this time and place in their life, this is who they are, and God is at work in them. They're developing and changing over the years. What if I could? Because acceptance is a deep virtue. Because otherwise, I'm really not accepting the person as they are. I'm accepting a false image, right? It's just like God. I kind of like this person that I've created in my mind, but this person really kind of annoys me. But this is who they are. So let us, maybe for the next 2 weeks, I hope that comes to mind, learn to see people for who they are, not just as we wish them to be. Amen. And we come to the table of the Lord tonight as equals. I love that picture that Christ gives us a table, and we all come from whatever station of life and take from the same loaf and drink from the same cup, because we have all come to this story, this narrative, this person of Christ through faith. And God has justified our existence, and we all come with that same. I love that picture.